Notre Dame de la Fin. October 2011. I visited a great cathedral this week. It's situated in a mixed industrial, small business, residential area not far from the Portland airport. An odd place for a cathedral, but it has a huge congregation and is full of people, not just on Sundays, but every day of the week. And it's big. Notre Dame de Paris covers about 67,000 square feet. This one is nearly twice as big, 108,000 square feet, two full city blocks, and its overflow adjunct building across the river covers 94,000 square feet. Notre Dame, with its towers, is much taller and is built of stone all carved with saints and gargoyles and is endearingly ancient and beautiful. This one looks rather unimpressive as you approach it, partly because there are buildings near it and you can't really get a view of it, and partly because it wasn't built long ago to celebrate and embody spiritual worship, but recently in dire need for a specific material purpose. Still, I wouldn't discount a very large element of the spirit in the building of it. From the outside, it looks like a particularly huge warehouse, but it hasn't the strangely menacing, fortress-like look of the great windowless citadels of consumerism, Walmart, and the rest. When you get inside, you see the cathedral. The high, airy entrance hall leads you first on an elegantly stone-tiled floor with little bronze decorations set in here and there to an area of offices and cubicles. Most churches hide their administrative department, but this one puts it right out front. The walls are blonde wood, everything is spacious and handsome. Like the high nave of Notre Dame, the startlingly high steel-braced wooden ceiling soars above all the human activity down on the floor beneath. In the old cathedral, that height creates a great mysterious upper space of shadows, but the space beneath this vault is luminous. It wasn't until I entered the interior, the cathedral proper, that I understood why they'd built the ceiling so high. As there should be, there are great doors to open into the sacred space, and as a sacred space will do, the first sight took my breath away. I stood silent. I remembered what the word awe means. Much of the interior of the huge building is visible from that doorway, or would be except that the whole floor is covered with immense, towering blocks and piles and stacks of crates, cartons, boxes, and containers, arranged in gigantically severe order, with wide aisles between each tower or bay. Only down the aisles can you see the far walls in the far distance. There are no permanent walls or divisions. The immense, splendidly cantilevered ceiling stretches serenely above it all. The air is cool, fresh, and clean, with the faintest smell of garden stuff, fresh vegetables. Vehicles run quietly up and down the aisles, many forklifts and the like, looking quite tiny among the high blocks and stacks, constantly busy at moving crates and boxes, bringing in and taking out. Well, it isn't a cathedral. That was a metaphor. It's just a warehouse after all. But what kind of warehouse stores nothing to sell? Nothing, not one item in all these literally acres of goods is or ever will be for sale. Actually, it's a bank, but not the kind of bank where money is the only thing that happens. Here is where money doesn't happen. This is the Oregon Food Bank. Every box in the great cubicle stacks between the aisles, every carton, every can, every bottle, every crate holds food. Every carton, every can, every pound, every ounce of that food will be given to the people of Oregon who haven't the money to buy what they need to live on. It is a cathedral, after all, the cathedral of hunger. Or should I say the cathedral of generosity, of compassion, or community, or caritas? It comes to the same thing. There are people who need help. There are people who deny it, saying that God helps those who help themselves, and the poor and unemployed are merely shiftless slackers sponging on a nanny government. There are people who don't deny poverty, but they don't want to know about it because it's all so terrible, and what can you do? And then there are people who help. This place is the most impressive proof of their existence I ever saw. Their existence, their efficiency, their influence. This place embodies human kindness. In, of course, the most unspiritual, lowly, humdrum, even gross way, in 1,000 cans of green beans, in towers of macaroni boxes, in crates of fresh-picked vegetables, in cold side chapel refrigerators of meat and cheese, in hundreds of cartons with improbable names of obscure beers on them, donated by the brewers because beer cartons are particularly sturdy and useful for packing food, in the men and women, employees and trained volunteers, operating the machinery, manning the desks, sorting and packaging the fresh produce, teaching survival skills in the food bank classrooms, kitchens, and gardens, driving the trucks that bring food in and the trucks that take food out to where it's needed. For these towering walls and blocks and reefs of goods, 12 to 18,000 pounds of food in each bay of the warehouse will vanish, melt away like sandcastles tonight or in a few days, to be replaced instantly by the supply of boxed, canned, glassed, fresh, and frozen food, which in turn will melt away in a day or a week, going where it's needed. And that's everywhere. The food bank distributes in every county of the state of Oregon, plus one county of Washington State. They don't have to look far to find people who need help getting enough to eat. Anywhere kids are, to start with. Many school-aged children in our country, towns, and cities don't get 3 meals a day, or even 2. Many aren't always sure if they'll get anything to eat today at all. How many? About 1/3 of them. 1 child in 3. Put it this way. If you or I were a statistic parent with 3 statistic kids in school, one of our 3 children would be hungry, malnourished, hungry in the morning, hungry at night, the kind of hungry that makes a child feel cold all the time, makes a child stupid, makes a child sick. Which one of our children, which child,